control mechanism by governments to deny individuals their rights, and it won't work.
We have to leave it there, but we're going to do part two with you and post online at democracynow.org. Rami Khoury, Senior Public Policy Fellow, American University of Beirut, now at Harvard Kennedy School's Middle East Initiative. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hello, KBOO members. Thank you for being a part of our amazing community. Please join us this year at Mike to the People, our annual election meeting. Do you want to help steer KBOO in a positive direction this fall? Plan on attending the annual election meeting, Mike to the People, September 14th from noon to 3 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater and make your voice heard. Cast your vote by 1 p.m. at the event and enjoy refreshments and live entertainment with local musicians West Coast Black Bear and Izzy BM. Hear a report back from your board of directors and get to know this year's candidates. Record your fondest memories of KBOO in a minute or less at the Mic to the People booth. This is an all-ages and disability-affirmative event. Again, that's the annual election meeting, Mic to the People, Saturday, September 14th from noon to 3 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street, featuring West Coast Black Bear and Izzy BM. More information can be found at kboo.fm/meeting2019. Remember, your voice matters.
What might an artist near the end of a well-lived life tell us about the creative process and the personal qualities or values they think are important for living a good life? Hi, I'm Bob Madar, inviting you to come on over to Local Folks Podcast for our last visit with Mickey and listen to him talk about what he has learned after 96 years on the planet. You can find Local Folks at kboo.fm. Go to audio, list of programs, podcasts, web only, and click on Local Folks.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from Grindel's Coffee House, located at East Burnside Street and 8th Avenue in Portland, offering organic coffee, daily soup specials, sandwiches, and more for breakfast and lunch. They're open daily until 5 p.m. For more information on the Grindel's you can go to Grindel's Facebook page or by phone at 503-595-9550. Grindel's Coffee House, making KBOO programming possible. Up next, Wednesday Morning Talk Radio with Paul Roland.
I'm just an orphan of World War II, a parent of World War III. If I choose to lay down with the builders of bombs and the vendors of insanity, and still go along with it all, right or wrong, if it's something I somehow can't buy. I'm just an orphan of World War II, rehearsing for World War III. Beaten up in Chicago's streets with the cameras of NBC. The freedom I had, you have labeled a fad, to be cured with scissors and soap. I'm just an orphan of World War II. I've laid down in front of your place. I've pleaded and sung at the top of my lungs, but I'm something you don't want to face. Just kick me around in the suburbs of town till I drop out and split for the north. I'm just an orphan of World War II, a parent of World War III. If I choose to lay down with the builders of bombs and the vendors of insanity.
And good morning. Here we are once again. Wednesday's rolled around. This is Wednesday Talk Radio here on KBOO in Portland. I'm Paul Rowland. Be with you for the next hour. And that was John Hartford, the great, one of my favorite artists in the folk Americana vein of all time, from his 1969 self-titled release, John Hartford, Orphan of World War III. You may hear another song from that album as we go out today. That's from 1969. Anybody who listens to my first and third Thursday Rise When the Rooster Crows early morning folk show knows that over the past couple years I've been featuring music from 1968 and 1969, you know, the month that, or even sometimes the week that the show is in. Anyway, I've been thinking about 1969 a lot myself. Everybody's talking about Woodstock, and I actually saw a new documentary on Woodstock that was, you know, warmed the cockles of my heart. But, you know, I guess I, for some reason, never thought in conjunction these two events. But, you know, before Woodstock happened, actually, the Manson murders happened. Of course, they didn't actually get caught until months afterwards, so that, well, I mean, obviously, the fact that Sharon Tate and a bunch of other people were viciously murdered in their home in Hollywood obviously made sensational headlines, but the connection to the Manson gang didn't happen until later. Anyway, there's a new book out. I'm going to be talking about this and that and the other thing today. I'm here by myself, so you're free to call in and, pick up the thread of the conversation, possibly lead it in another direction. 503-231-8187. Anyway, I'm really, really, really hoping to get this author, Tom O'Neill, of this book that's only been out a couple months, Chaos, Charles Manson, the CIA, and the Secret History of the 60s. Just finished this the other day. It's a mind blower of a book for me. Of course, I've discovered that if I had actually been paying more attention, Paul Krassner, the relatively recently deceased path-breaking investigative journalist and provocateur, co-founder of the Yippies, he had written quite extensively, one of the few people who really tried to plumb the depths of the meaning, context, and origins of the Manson phenomenon, as it were. I'm not sure if it was he who floated the idea that there was possible CIA involvement with their totally obscene and disgusting program, MK Ultra, mind control experimentation program, which was a thing indeed. In fact, it goes into the history of MK Ultra fairly extensively in this book. I don't know how much to say, because as I say, I really do want to have Tom O'Neill on. I just wrote him a letter last night. And but I'd encourage people to get this book. It's a pretty expensive book. It's a pretty hefty book. It's out there at your local bookstores. But it'd be interesting to have more of a conversation, because, you know, as we've gone through 1968, the year of KBOO's birth, now coming on the end of 1969 and the 50th anniversary, all the 50th anniversaries around those monumental years, the idea of the end of the 60s, does anybody want to talk about the end of the 60s, was quite a big deal. I know I've said this on my show a fair amount, that was a time of really remarkable opening up of potentialities, possibilities, struggles on so many different fronts, so many movements that continue to this day had, if not their first origin, possibly their major impulse, or a renewed impulse anyway. Certainly women's rights have been around as long as there's been patriarchy. There's you know, various forms of civil and human rights have been around ever since there's been racism and colonization and other forms of oppression. But the 60s really coalesced so many different things. Obviously, the civil rights movement, which itself, the African-American civil rights movement, which is what we think of as a civil rights movement, which may not be, may be a little too exclusive, of course, but that's another question. But that obviously had a long, long history, but it started, it really had a renewed vigor in the 50s and continued into the 60s. But anyway, there's so many, the gay rights movement with Stonewall, obviously, has a longer history, but you know, so many things, because there was so much ferment in general. You know, I think it had a lot to do with the decolonization, worldwide decolonization movement. Obviously, it had a lot to do with sort of the explosion of industrial capacity after the world and the rise of this large so-called middle class. And you know, that's what a lot of people analyze as the 60s, the, you know, the rise of a lot of free time for all these educated white people and not. Anyway, the end of that period is, I see as a really tragic thing, because I see that was, you know, one of our sort of last best hopes in a way. It was, and one of the biggest challenges to the mega machine, the, well, now they call it the, Amy Goodman called it the Coke-tipus on her show on Charles Koch, who died, show yesterday, this new book about the Koch Empire. But obviously it goes way back. It's a long, long historical process. The United States, of course, is the kind of the culmination in some ways of that long historical process. Perhaps the most egregious example of concentration of power through the concentration of lands, through the colonization of the Americas, through the imposition of forced labor with slavery and the mass immigration and the virtual forced wage slavery in the burgeoning factors. I also watched The Gilded Age on PBS, a two-hour special last night, which was really, to me, again, mind-blowing. I know I and all of us should know this history a lot better, but I didn't know a lot of the details of the, you know, the so-called robber baron age, the Vanderbilts, the Carnegies, and the Rockefellers. Of course, now Trump being sort of the tragic farcical iteration of that process. Anyway, I'm going in a lot of different directions, but this book, it talks about the impact that the Manson murders had specifically on, you know, the quote hippie scene. But I think it was a lot more than that, because, you know, whatever one thinks of the quote hippies, and I know there's a lot of stereotypes, there was a lot of, there's a serious questioning of the deep underlying sort of Protestant racist sort of power control mechanization mentality of the United States. And there is a lot of experimentation going on, experimentation of different forms of consciousness, experimentation of different lifestyles, experimentation of, you know, the use of public space was a huge thing. You know, people were able to hitchhike around, people were able to travel. Some people, obviously white people, white straight people, probably a lot more easily. But so many things started to come to an end. You know, people talk about Altamont sort of being the end, but the Manson murders had just a huge influence. Anyway, this book goes into excruciating detail about what the Manson murders meant, and just the fact that he doesn't come to a firm conclusion. I guess I don't know if this is a spoiler, but you know, he doesn't. He kind of leaves a lot sort of tantalizingly out there. He doesn't necessarily find the absolute proof of the, you know, the scenario that he seems to lean to, but the book is worth it in getting the context and the sort of the build up to that moment and its aftermath. And I mean, I guess I could talk a little bit more about the MK Ultra. As I say, I hope to have Tom O'Neill. He's the author of this book, Chaos: Charles Manson, the CIA, and the Secret History of the 60s. There is in Haight-Ashbury in 1967, there's clinic, the Haight-Ashbury Free Medical Clinic, and there's people associated with that clinic who had CIA connections and were actually doing experimentation. There was a guy who was directly connected to MK Ultra. He was like one of their kind of Mengele type dudes. I mean, this guy was a bad dude. He experimented on, seems to have experimented on army personnel. They experimented on prisoners. Anyway, he wanted to nip the psychedelic revolution in the bud. And a scenario that's out there is that they actually basically created the Manson family through, it's not known what means exactly they use or might have used. There's a lot of circumstantial case on of the based upon the kind of research that this guy was doing. His nickname was Jolly. Oh my God, what's his last name? Anyway, there's a David Smith, Roger Smith, and this other guy. I'll get his name here in a second. But he actually was there in Haight-Ashbury. He had this house that was like a crash pad in which he studied the hippies. He let people crash there, and they had a bunch of graduate students studying them. But what else he was doing, we don't actually know. Anyway, I'll kind of leave it tantalizingly there. If anybody wants to follow up on that, I'd love to talk to you about it. Again, the importance of it for me is the lengths. You know, we know that the FBI and others were involved in the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King. It does seem to me that there is pretty good evidence that the CIA was involved in the assassination of Kennedy. I know this is conspiracy theory, but these are hypotheses. We know the lengths that head of the FBI, my name is blanking here, he was heavily involved in the suppression through COINTELPRO, through Operation Chaos that disrupted the Black Panthers. We know that the lengths that they went to, hell, we know that the lengths they go to now, it's nothing has, you know, nothing has really changed. Whatever you think of 9/11, to me, the very good possibility that they actually allowed that to happen as a way of putting a kibosh on the rising anti-globalization movement, which is sort of the latest iteration of this long process of resistance to which I'm referring. Anyway, we know the links that they'll go to suppress. I'm watching that Gilded Age last night, the Homestead Strike, the crushing of the Homestead Strike in 1893, I believe, and on and on and on and on. But for some reason, this book, it just was a real page turner. I finished it in like 2 or 3 days. I haven't done that in a long time. It really coalesced a lot of things to me because I've been actually reading about the Haight-Ashbury period, some notes from the New Underground, and get the name of this other book, which was published in 1968 with a bunch of interviews with primary figures from the Haight-Ashbury. Anywho, that's one thing I wanted to talk about. I want to talk about this this Gilded Age, sort of the, you know, I think the obvious echoes from that to the current era, you know, the post-70s, the whole the renewed rise of Wall Street, the renewed the rise of the financialization, you know, the transition from a so-called productive industrial economy to a financialized economy with all the derivatives. Again, you know, this is an old capitalist process, but this kind of a more recent mutation that sort of we saw the, you know, we see the fruits of it in Trump, the whole the absolute corruption of the capitalist system, which basically has thrown away any pretense at morality and sort of the, you know, as they talk about in that PBS special, The Gilded Age, the, you know, the older elites having a sort of sense of decorum and manners that, like, the new nouveau riche, the Vanderbilts, sort of the what based upon the, you know, the hyper-industrialization in the mid to late 19th century, 1800s, fueled by, you know, the rise of the steel industry, the exploitation of the vast coal reserves of Appalachia, and the joining it together with the iron, vast iron reserves in various parts of the country, the railroads, the, you know, the steel mills, the all that, which gave rise to the Gilded Age, and sort of the throwing away with the Trump phenomenon of any pretense, as I say, you know, basically out of a form of desperation. In fact, I think there's a certain desperation behind all of Trump, combined with his narcissism. You know, whether or not he ascended the presidency to kind of try to save himself from the cumulative debts and results of his reckless approach to wealth accumulation, you know, in the, you know, getting in bed with the Russian oligarchs, and now with the strange bedfellows, the right wing evangelists, the right wing fundamentalists, and they're again totally throwing away any pretense of real common sense morality, and falling in bed with Trump anyway. I could go on and on. Again, 503-231-8187 is the number to call if I've stimulated your interest in any subject. And another article I came across from Counterpunch called Notes on Inauthenticity in a Creeping Fascist Nuthouse by Paul Street on August 23rd of last week, which really struck me along these same lines. I think I'll read a little bit about that article. Among the suggestions I would have made to the Yale philosophy professor Jason Stanley had I been an editor of his important book, How Fascism Works, The Politics of Us and Them, from last year, two seem particularly relevant in the present political juncture. The first suggestion would have been for Stanley to explicitly call out the state capitalist and corporate captive Democratic Party in his perceptive discussion of how the fascist-style 2016 U.S. presidential candidate Donald Trump got to come off as more authentic than his major party opponent, while habitually telling untruths and giving voice to shocking sentiments that were presumed to be unsuitable for public discourse. As Stanley rightly pointed out, Democratic candidates, quote, must raise huge sums to run for office. As a result, they represent the interests of their large donors. However, because it is a democracy, they must also try to make the case that they represent the common interest. They must pretend that the best interests of the multinational corporations that fund their campaigns are also the common interest. That's a quote from that book by Stanley. Jason Stanley, I'm not sure why Stanley thought the United States is a democracy. It is no such thing. But he put his thumb on a basic and long-standing conundrum in bourgeois politics. Compared with the fake progressivism and pretend populism that results from the plutocratic contradictions, parentheses hardly restricted just to campaign finance matters, that plague liberal and social democratic politics under capitalism within and beyond the U.S., The openly racist and sexist ruling class thug from Queens, Donald Trump, was taken for speaking his mind, exhibiting, quote, classic demagogic behavior that, quote, came to be seen in the more authentic as the more authentic candidate, even when he is manifestly dishonest. That's a good and important point, relevant to our understanding neo-fascist political success beyond as well as within the U.S. I thought back to Stanley's book when I read this in a recent Salon interview with the legendary liberal investigative journalist Seymour Hersh. Chauncey DeVega from Salon. You have studied and written about some of the most powerful people in America and the world. What do you want the American people to know about their behavior and character as a group? Seymour Hersh. I think it is inevitable that you don't get truth tellers. I want the American people to stop believing everything they hear and to ask more questions, to become more skeptical. I think it's the one reason a guy like Donald Trump won. They understood where he was coming from, that Trump was just a blowhard. They laughed at him. They knew Trump doesn't know what he's talking about. But Trump wasn't the same old big smile and a lot of good words. The Democrats have been going around saying, we're for the people, we're for the little guy. And all they do is run to Wall Street for money. And the one guy that didn't, Sanders, was sabotaged by the Democratic National Committee. But this is nothing remotely new. Yes, Virginia, the Democrats have an authenticity problem. You betcha. The late left Princeton political scientist Sheldon Wolin memorably labeled the Democrats as, get this, the inauthentic opposition 12 years ago. Quote, should Democrats somehow be elected, Wolin prophesied in his book Democracy Incorporated, Manage Democracy in the Specter of Inverted Totalitarianism, they would do nothing to, quote, alter significantly the direction of society or substantially reverse the drift rightwards. The timidity of a Democratic Party mesmerized by centrist precepts, Wolin wrote, points to the crucial fact that for the poor, minorities, the working class, and the anti-corporatists, there is no opposition party working on their behalf. The corporatist Democrats would work to, quote, marginalize any possible threat to the corporate allies of the Republicans. Wolin called it. A nominal Democrat was elected president along with Democratic majorities in both houses of Congress in 2008. What followed under Barack Obama, as under his Democratic presidential predecessor Bill Clinton, was a standard elite neoliberal manipulation of campaign populism and identity politics in service to the reigning big money bankrollers in their global empire. Wall Street's control of Washington and the related imperial agenda of the Pentagon system were advanced more effectively by the nation's first black president than they could have been by stiff and wealthy white Republicans like John McCain or Mitt Romney. The reigning U.S. system of corporate and imperial inverted totalitarianism, that's Wolin, was given a deadly fake democratic rebranding. The underlying drift rightward sharpened, fed by a widespread and easily Republican exploited sense of popular abandonment and betrayal as the hypocritical and inauthentic dollar Democrats depressed and demobilized their own purported popular base. Hillary Clinton did nothing to correct that problem in 2016. Quite the opposite. With a colossal campaign finance war chest fed not just by the usual Wall Street and Silicon Valley suspects, but also by many traditionally Republican big money donors who were repelled by Trump's faux populism, the transparently corporate establishmentarian candidate, Clinton, could barely deign to pretend to be a progressive. She ran almost completely on the argument that Trump was too terrible and unqualified to be president, making candidate character and qualities her sole selling point was a critical and historical mistake given the angry and anti-establishment mood of the electorate and her own epic unpopularity. So was calling Trump's flyover county supporters a, quote, basket of racist and sexist deplorables, and a sneering comment, one that accurately reflected her aristocratic, progressive, neoliberal worldview to rich Manhattan campaign donors. And this continues for several pages, so I won't read the whole thing. Looks like we might have a caller. That's Notes on Inauthenticity in a Creeping Fashion Nuthouse by Paul Street from August 23rd on Counterpunch. And you know, I mean, this extends to the, you know, the vast majority of, you know, well-meaning liberal nonprofit campaigns and organizations. Unfortunately, there's a, you know, we're just not getting the desperateness and direness of the situation, and the way the existent structure of reality determines the way things are going, and that we have to shake ourselves out of this existent framework of institutional consciousness. Anyway, and that goes back to my point about the 60s, when there seriously was a breaking out of that, as messy and as contradictory, and, you know, criticize everybody as you will, but it still was happening. If you read some of the stuff that came out, and I think actually go into a few years later, I still think that some of the stuff that came out in the early 70s is some of the, I don't know, I consider some of like the highlight intellectually. Baudrillard's The Mirror of Production, this book I'm reading now in Italian, which I'm hoping to translate, called The Psychopathology of Unlived Daily Life, by this guy Piero Coppo, that my friends at Nautilus, the great anarchist publishing group in Torino, Italy, and some of Rozak's stuff, as somewhat contradictory as it might be. Anyway, it looks like we do have a caller, and that is Arthur. What would you like to tell us, Arthur?
Well, hi there, Paul. I'd like to interrupt your train of thought there and start a discussion.
Please do.
Hello?
Yeah, we're here.
Well, it's hard to compare the Gilded Age to today's world. The kind of poverty that was experienced then, especially in the cities, was so much worse than what we see now. It's bad nowadays, of course, and the haves and the haves not has historically always been around. So you could say in the 60s drove people then to madness, to insanity, and what happened with the Manson murders. But that happens. I just to make the comparisons between today and other times and period of in history, it's hard to do.
Well, really. I don't know. You can't. There are comparisons, and then there's differences, and you compare the similarities and compare the differences.
Right. Well, today's world, the haves, I think, are displaying their wealth in the hotels that are going up. You know, world travel is really a luxury, especially in today's world. Flying is contributing to global warming and the collapse of the ecology. But the rich are just perfectly happy with traveling around the world. And stadiums are one sign of wealth, you know, extreme wealth, entertainment for the wealthy, you know. And I think our current politics, I'm not a supporter of our mayor, but I think he's bending over backwards to serve the wealthy. And the have-nots, while the have-nots, we have a homeless situation, and I always say anybody living on the streets can go crazy. It can, and it has happened, you know, absolutely crazy. It's just terrible to see and not be able to do anything about, and the city makes some effort, but it's not enough. So I just wanted to, you know, interject in that way.
Okay.
Comparisons between today and other times in history, and how there are similarities and dissimilarities, even the hotels that are going up, hotels over time reverted into housing. They started out as hotels and they became housing.
Well, yeah, so I mean, we need to reappropriate the wealth and all that, you know, the constructed environment, which is so utterly destructive. We need to reappropriate that for the people, like the populist movement tried to do in the 1880s and 90s, and like the movements in the 1920s, 30s, and the 60s. And today, it's a long struggle, and we can't give up. I mean, in the face of climate devastation, which it's easy to despair over with all the fires going on all over the world, not just the Amazon, Africa.
Yeah, well, Arctic. Let me just add one last thing. Transportation. You know, I mentioned hotels because that's it's serving transportation, travel around the world as a luxury. And if we couldn't travel as much as we do, we'd be addressing how we build, how we live, how we serve the needs of the most desperate.
Mm-hmm.
If we couldn't fly as much as we do and drive in our cars everywhere all the time, and we had to make arrangements for, you know, decent livings closer to home, and that would be a change in the way that we could say we'd be addressing the not just the poverty, but how we relate to our living in the environment. You know, our life, part of a living enjoyment of life is the beauty of nature, and yet we are in our cars all the time driving around and arguing with each other, and you know, along those lines, I would say I wouldn't give up hope just yet, but don't count on the self-driving car to be any kind of a solution at all. It's not going to happen. Okay, nice talking to you, Paul.
Yeah, thank you, Arthur. Appreciate that. Yeah, the whole air travel needs to be drastically cut back, as well as ocean travel. You know, this whole issue of the tariffs, I find interesting in that, you know, I think we should have massive tariffs on everything, because I don't think we should have so much international trade, because I don't think we should be shipping stuff all over the globe, because, you know, a lot of the stuff that we produce, right, you know, here, regionally, locally, nationally, is we also import from, you know, wherever, China or Vietnam or, you know, and the wealth should stay mostly where it comes from and benefit the majority of the people where it comes from, instead of this global capitalist machine. Anyway, I could go on about that, but we got Mark on the line also. Go ahead, Mark.
Hello?
Hello.
Is my phone working all right?
We hear you loud and clear.
Okay. I want to continue with one topic that the previous caller brought up, basically about the haves and the have-nots, and to sort of focus in on the homeless problem, okay? But not just about the problem. See, a lot of people are good at identifying problems. You know, we can identify a lot of problems with Donald Trump. You know, we can talk about the problems all day long. Does anybody have any solutions? That's what I'm interested in. So back to the have and the have-nots and the homeless situation. I live in Salem, and we really have a problem down here. And one of the problems that I see is that the providers to services are all low. There are three main providers that give free lunches, free clothes, you know, services, but they're all located in the same area. So we really have a, you know, conglomeration of homeless people in the downtown Salem area. Okay, nobody's coming up with any solutions about what to do. All the homeless people want handouts. They want, you know, housing. They want free food.
Wait a second, handouts. I mean, that's kind of a loaded phrase, handouts.
Okay, but that's what they want.
Well, loaded, what do you mean? They want what's everybody's right to have, being as a human being living on planet Earth. We have a right to eat, to drink water, to drink good water, to have a place to live. And there's people who are hoarding the wealth, who won't share it with other people. That's what creates the homeless problem. There's plenty of housing. There's way more available units than there are people living without their own home or house. But why are they going vacant? Because of speculative capitalism. So that is where we need to address our focus.
Okay, can I say something?
Of course.
All right. Okay, so I live in Salem, and there's lots of Republicans around here. I am not one of them, but I talk to a lot of them, and they don't want their tax dollars going to, you know, provide free housing to people that are not. There's no solution that can put some of these people to work. There is none. Okay? That's what I'm concerned about.
Right, but that's a structure. I'm saying it's a structural problem, and we need to address it structurally. It's a problem of the way we organize our economic system.
Sure. No, I don't agree with it, because it's a lot of it's based on education. What the have and the have not. Some people have a, you know, college degree. They know how to be employed. The homeless people, their skills, you know, to find employment aren't really good.
I think you're making great generalizations here. How many people have you talked to?
Hey, I'm just saying. Great generalizations. These people don't have the skills to go to work.
How do you know that? Have you talked to people?
Absolutely. Uh-huh. There's a homeless drop-in center a half a block from where I live. I see homeless people all day long. I'm not really trying to be judgmental of them. I'm just saying, you know, some people know how to, you know, work within the system. Right. I think the system needs to invite them in a little bit more.
No, I think I'm saying we need to change the system. The system is the problem.
Yeah, I think so too.
All right.
I agree.
So then we got to work together.
But I think there need to be some ideas put into place that can, you know, and they don't have to make people suffer. I mean, I wonder about things that could be created to help people get, you know.
All right, well, that's reasonable.
Just interrupted me.
Okay.
Let me finish. There need to be some ideas created, you know, to include these people into the ones that can work into a working structure.
No, I agree. I guess I was going to say I've heard of a lot. There's a lot of really good models out there. They say that basically, well, you know, in various cities. I know in Utah there is a really good model of basically when you give people a place to live, give them the support that they need, it costs a lot less money to society than letting people live out on the streets and run ragged, basically, as you said, you know. It's like well, as a previous caller said, I don't know if I agree with the terminology, but it's easy to kind of to rapidly or slowly lose your sense of yourself, to lose your self-esteem, whatever skills you might have had, you start to lose them when you're living on the streets because it wears you down. So if you we need to shift our resources from, you know, wherever, you know, certain kinds of taxation, taxation on the empty. My co-hosts on the third Wednesday show here talk about, you know, a taxation on empty units that are being speculatively held off the market. So yes, we need to shift the wealth to give it to stabilize people's lives so that they actually have a place to live. They have the, you know, the health care that they need. If they need mental health care, if they need job training, whatever. But the thing is, the system is not oriented that way. And the pressure on, you know, to take funding away from those systems is great. So, yeah, I mean, the ideas have been out there for, you know, forever, basically. Give people a place to live. You know,
I think they need to find some work first, and I need to think. I think they need... Can I talk, please?
Well, no. I think we need to move on. We have two other callers, so we got to go. We got to go on. But yeah, I mean, we need to give people the support systems that they need, and we need to. There's plenty of possibilities for jobs. It's just that the system creates a artificial scarcity. Anyway, let's go to Helen. You're on the air now. Hello, Helen.
So many subjects.
Indeed.
Okay, so. The first thing that I listened to Mindhunter watched it on Netflix, and so they would talk to different people, but I know that this stuff is true, and they did talk to Manson, you know, I mean, but it was theater, you know, I mean, on Netflix, but the idea, he was such a good manipulator, they had to change the garden, like, you know, every half hour or something like that, because he had such control over people. Okay, the next thing is, What's My Line? What was the lady? I want to say Kilgallen. I can't remember. She was a writer. Do you remember?
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Okay, that was during Kennedy's time. I forget what her name was, but she was killed because she knew everything about the killing of Kennedy. It was the mafia. I was listening to the radio last night. It was really, really good. Anyway, so the third thing is the hippie time. Well, I remember because I was older, and my mother used to say, "You need, when you get married, you need to have health insurance. You need to have stability. You need to have all this stuff." And it's like, and they thought, "Well, what is this for?" You know, gas was 28 cents a gallon, and the one thing that really started all that was the birth control, the freedom. It was a lot of freedom then, and it was really a beautiful time. I remember going to San Francisco in 1968, and I said to myself, history is being made at this moment. I mean, it was amazing down there. I mean, I just like to look at the very good side of things. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and then it started changing. And also with the drugs, when people continued using the drugs, it wasn't a good idea because at the beginning when they had the drugs, it was like lifting the veil of seeing so much. But then later it just caused people a lot of difficulties, you know.
Well,
but
I think
anyway.
the drugs also changed, and there might be reasons why they changed. Methamphetamines kind of came in and sort of took over from LSD. Of course, you know, the whole issue of using LSD, what circumstances, whether people used it wisely or whatever, but one issue is just, you know, the quantity or the setting in which you use it. But another is that the drugs actually kind of harder drugs took over, you know, from the psychedelics in the Haight-Ashbury lead to the transformation.
Well, that, LSD. I only took it a few times, but I can tell you that I can see it in my mind, what I experienced. It was like one up in Washington at the beach, and another one was at a concert, one of the earlier concerts in Vancouver, and we were with another couple. We debated about taking this little piece of paper. We kept sitting and talking about it and debating because we just didn't know what to do, but it was not harmful, but it was amazing. So, you know, and there were the posters in San Francisco. I collected the posters. I mean, there were so many beautiful things during that time. I mean, really was very special.
All right. Well, thank you for that.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, that the book goes into in great detail again a lot of what Helen's talking about, sort of the shift that took place in specifically Haight-Ashbury in 1967 going into 68. And anyway, we could go talk about, it's interesting that there's kind of a resurgence now in interest. I know Michael Pollan's book, P-O-L-L-A-N, can't remember the name of it recently, about his use of psychedelics, the whole using microdosing. There's a lot of new research, really good research into the use of psilocybin and MDA and other substances for therapeutic uses, something that kind of went away for largely for a long period of time because of the prohibition on the psychedelics. I'd like to, before we go to Michael, I'd like you all to know that coming up next on The Radioactivist will be guest host Rochelle Dixon. 10 Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11 is Radio Zine. All these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member and haven't yet done so, go to kbo.fm and click on donate. I'm Paul Rowland. This is a kind of a me flying solo, a bit of a freewheeling show this morning on Wednesday Talk Radio. Looks like we got another caller. We got about 10 minutes left. Go ahead, Michael, you're on the air.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that if you look back at the history of LSD, we gave it out at the Stanford VA hospital to people like Ken Kesey and probably the guy that started the whole Earth Catalog, whose name escapes me right this second.
Stuart Brand.
Yeah, Stuart Brand, that's right. So they kind of started this thing. And an interesting footnote, the reason I called is that I'm in the computer world, and there's a guy who actually is from here originally named Doug Engelbart, who got a group together down there, and what they were doing was taking acid to see if they could figure out how to use computers to help computers augment human abilities. And what came out of that was everything we have now. The mouse came out of that, separate windows came out of that, graphical user interfaces came out of that. So
unfortunately, I'm not a big fan of the computer revolution myself.
Well, okay, well, be that as it may, it's just interesting to me that it came out of LSD, and there's a really interesting book that someone wrote about it. I don't remember the author's name, but the title is What the Dormouse Said. Dormouse is D-O-R-M-O-U-S-E. It's a line from a Jefferson Airplane song called White Rabbit. But anyways, the whole computer revolution started with LSD. So I thought that was an interesting thing to add to the conversation.
No, I appreciate that.
And one more thing. So I was a hippie. I was part of this cosmic consciousness wing of the hippie movement. And it was really disillusioning because I thought me and all my brothers in the revolution of consciousness were going to change the world through the sheer virtue of what we believed in and what we could, you know, do with our minds and all. And then 1974 came along, and 90% of the people that I thought were my brothers and sisters in the revolution were suddenly wearing polyester suits and doing cocaine and going to discos. And I realized I had been part of a huge wave of trend victims, and suddenly they had all moved on to the next trend. So it was kind of discouraging. But
I don't think they were all just following trends. I think there was some serious organizing. It wasn't just on the level of consciousness. It was actually on a material reality as well. People were actually trying to challenge the systems of patriarchy, white supremacy. You know, I'm not sure that how well developed it actually was, but there was imperialism, the war machine. There was people actually challenging the centers of power and control. You know, obviously consciousness raising was a big part of that, but I think you have to wed consciousness raising with organizing and action and building serious alternatives, and of course there was a lot of that going on, but there was also a lot of direct suppression and undermining of that by the state and the corporate sector.
Well, that's true also, but it's also true that 90% of the hippies I knew were all of a sudden into disco instead. And how do you go from cosmic consciousness to disco unless you were never really into the cosmic consciousness in the first place?
Well, because
that was the disillusionment.
Well, it was because the zeitgeist shifted, and the Manson murders that's why I was talking about the Manson murders, because that helped, among many other things, shift both the zeitgeist and started to restrict, public space. Like, all of a sudden, hitchhiking was a little more difficult. All of a sudden, people were more distrustful of each other. People were distrustful. You know, before the Manson murders, hippies were basically seen as relatively innocuous. There's a lot of opposition, the sort of stereotypical, factory worker, whatever, to use a horrible stereotype, the confrontation over appearance and values and stuff. But generally speaking, they weren't seen as bad. But the Manson murders really did help shift. The idea that was actually a CIA operation. There hasn't been the definitive proof, but there is circumstantial evidence pointing at the possibility that Manson was created, that really had a serious impact. And then there was the whole, the rise of the Koch brothers and the rise of the Enterprise Institute and the think tanks, the Ronald Reagan reaction as governor and then as later as president. There's a whole history to the trying to bury the movement and impulse of the 60s, the Cointelpro, the Operation Chaos, which was a CIA operation also, to turn African American black power activists against each other. There's these behind the scenes movements, J. Edgar Hoover's Cointelpro operation, and of course, people were, the hippies weren't fully, they were just starting to explore, and a lot of them, sure, they were sort of trendy. That's the nature of things. There's, in a mass culture, where people aren't really grounded in strongly in solidarity and community, you're going to have a lot of phenomena like that. You're going to have a lot of people just following. But there was a lot of serious oppositional stuff going on.
Well, that's all true, but what's also true is that me and my friends, my real friends, didn't...
Well, looks like we lost our caller. Well, let's just go straight to Pear on line two. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Hey, good morning, Paul.
Good morning.
Just a little bit of history about how the Haight-Ashbury scene got started.
Okay.
In San Francisco, up in North Beach, you know, the Beats were up there in North Beach, and there was an officer, Big Arani, who hated Beats. He went out, he vowed to drive them out of North Beach, and he did, and they all moved to the Haight-Ashbury and kind of started that scene.
So it's true that there was sort of this transition from the Beats to the hippies.
Right, yes, I think so.
Interesting. You know,
People overlap the two cultures. Later on, you know, then the Haight-Ashbury got very violent, and a lot of the hippies from Haight-Ashbury moved down to Noe Valley, where I lived, which sort of transformed it from a working-class neighborhood into a, sort of the in place to live in San Francisco.
So it's also true that the hippies, as well as, you know, the artists and sometimes even the anarchists, can be a sort of a forerunners of gentrification.
Oh, something like that. Well, that's usually what happens.
Yep.
Artists find a low rent neighborhood and they move in, they do creative things, and they kind of make the neighborhood bloom. And then all these people with money, they move in and try to suck off it and drive the rents up, and the artists leave. You know,
that's the capitalist system, isn't it?
Yes. Anyway, that's just my little contribution to history here.
Thank you. I appreciate that, Pear. Always good to hear from you. Well, let's sneak in Mark real quick. We only got a minute left.
Hi, Paul. I want to recommend researching community land trusts. There's a website, academia.edu, that has 20 million papers, and they could actually be the people's publisher. Community land trusts could provide permanent affordable housing by buying up existing property and having a 99-year ground lease, so that future generations of low and moderate income people would have affordable housing. Now, I also wanted to recommend Herbert Marcuse. He said the one-dimensional society is a society without opposition. And he firmly believes that we're caught in false needs and false consciousness.
Indeed. He was
so it's a very exciting perspective. I'm translating works of Eugen Drewermann, who's a critical anti-war activist and a church critic. And he says that the law of the free market is not a law. The laws are not laws. They're accidental psychological moods and
human inventions.
Yes, or they're fetishes.
Uh-huh.
It's a very important insight.
The whole idea of fetish is something I've wanted to explore more on this program. You brought up an issue that will take a long time to unpack, but we're going to have to go because we are flush out of time. Thanks for calling, Mark.
And the free markets aren't free.
Indeed. No such thing as a free lunch, as they say. All right. Thank you, Heather, for stepping in on the board. Appreciate it. We're going to go out with another last song from John Hartford, from his 1969 self-titled John Hartford. Thanks for listening, everybody.
I stumbled through a yellow field of dying grass. In front of me some happy people quickly passed, hailing deep the air.
Alyssa Pariah, your friendly neighborhood agitator, the host of The Struggle, every Friday from 7 to 8 p.m. Listen to KBOO Community Radio, 90.7 FM, and online at kboo.fm. The Struggle is where organizers and activists doing good in the community come to discuss their work to get you to support them, maybe even join them. Remember The Struggle, every Friday, 7 to 8 p.m., KBOO Community Radio.
KBOO proudly co-sponsors the Portland Folk Music Society concert series, featuring artists touring nationally and internationally. Shows start this September with Jim Queskin and Meredith Axelrod. The new season continues with artists Bill Staines, Radim Zenkel, and the Honey Whiskey Trio. Then 2020 kicks off with Kate Lee and Forrest O'Connor, followed by Sam Ryder and the Human Hands, Robin and Linda Williams, Pat Donahue, and Joni Harms. Portland Folk Music Society concerts are presented at the Reedwood Friends Church on Southeast Steel Street in Portland. For more information, go to the website kboo.fm and click on Community Events.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, and the Radio Activists is up next. They're running a little bit late, but so Paul and I are going to probably continue here. So that was a really good show this morning. I enjoyed the last point Mark brought up about community land trusts. There's a community in Boston that you should look up that definitely does that, where it's a collective. The property is owned by that collective, and they're responsible for the maintenance and provisions in that neighborhood. So not all neighborhood associations are, you know, to quote Hunter S. Thompson, outback Nazi law enforcement agencies.
So wait a second, that land trust was connected to a neighborhood association?